Last time, we worked our way through chapter 16, which we saw God's beginning of the providing manna. He also provided meat in the evening and initiated Sabbath observance. That's the big picture. They had left Elim 2 months after the Passover departure from Egypt. So in chapter 16, we were looking at about 2 months, roughly 60 days of their have been accomplished in their Exodus. And we see the whole congregation grumbling. Isn't that the way it works? They're saying, "We left full pots of meat in Egypt. Now we're out here to die of hunger in the wilderness. It would have been better if we had died at the Lord's hand in Egypt." What foolishness. What silliness. They've seen God's power at work. They've seen God's care for them, His love for them. They've seen His provision for them. They've seen that He is mightier than Egypt. They've seen Him provide for them day after day, time after time. And they're thinking now that they wish that God Himself would have taken their lives as He took the lives of the Egyptians. And the Lord then, in response to that, and as a test of the people, He rains bread from heaven. Now, this is not a natural phenomenon. We talked about that. They call it manna, which means what is it? We looked in Psalm 78 and saw that it was described there as them eating the bread of angels. And they gathered a portion for each one in the household. It worked out about right when they gathered with their good right intentions. The idea was that they would get an omer, or about 2 quarts per person, and those that gathered a lot had about the right amount, and those that gathered little had about the right amount. So we get to see God's hand at work even in their gathering. And so they gathered these portions, and Moses tells them, now don't hold this over to the next day. Consume it today. Tomorrow there will be a new batch. And, of course, what happened? What happened?
They hoarded it.
Yeah, some of them hoarded it anyway. And how did Moses respond to those that tried to save it? You remember?
He was angry with
them. He was angry. Why are you testing God? Don't you understand what's going on here? God had told Moses it was a test. They're failing the test. And oh, by the way, how appetizing. It grew worms and spoiled. How wonderful. And so overnight it becomes wormy and spoils. And of course, they did that for 6 days. And on the sixth day, they were to gather a double portion, enough for both the sixth day and the seventh, because on the seventh there was not to be any gathering. And they said, if you go out there and try to find some, you won't. And of course, they tried and they didn't. And then God also provided meat, it tells us. He provided quail that came and just covered the camp in the evening. And in the course of all this, Moses redirects them in their grumbling. Why are you grumbling to us? Speaking for himself and Aaron at that point. This isn't what we did. How did they get where they were? Pillar of fire, pillar of cloud. And God even showed himself in the pillar of cloud in a more glorious way during all of this grumbling. And so the following morning, after the quail comes, they're out there gathering again the manna daily. Did it the 6 day pattern that they had been given. Because the seventh day, we are taught, is to be holy to the Lord. And so it is a time to worship and to set apart and recognize God in His holiness and His provision for them. They said the manna was described like coriander seed, except they were white, which is about the size of Milo or something like that. They said it tasted like wafers and honey in its taste. And it was directed that one container, one omer, be kept and as a memorial, as a memory, an event memory starter. And at one point, that container will be placed in the Ark of the Covenant, which doesn't exist yet. And it's not quite a footnote, but almost. And then they ate the manna for 40 years until they were at the door of Canaan. So in the text, it looks ahead and sees that They're going to be consuming this manna for 40 years as they stumble around in the desert. Part of that time, the big portion of that time, is going to be in God's judgment of them with regard to their lack of faith as they are faced with the opportunity to enter the land of Canaan. And so that would be how God would care for them during that time. So with that, it brings us up to chapter 17. And so let's begin by looking at the first seven verses, and I'll read those for us. 17, 1 through 7. When all the congregation of the sons of Israel all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin according to the command of the Lord and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me." And the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, and that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So, in verse 1, it says they journeyed by stages, in the way the New American Standard says it, from the wilderness of Sin. Well, where is the wilderness of Sin? Well, it's out here in the Midian area, probably south of Mountain of God, of Mount Sinai, but it's really hard to know exactly where some of these things were, and we've talked about that. We can't really get in there and try to do anything with archaeological studies or anything. And it says they traveled by stages, and that's probably not too hard to understand, but if you look at the way the Hebrew idiom is put together, it said they journeyed by journeys. And what that really means is they made a path, but it was in segments as they went. So not every place they may have stopped for a period of time is named or described, but they made a series of journeys within that wilderness area, and that was done in according, in verse 1, to the command of the Lord. How did the Lord command them in their travels? The pillar of fire and a pillar of cloud. So the Lord moved them as he wanted them to move. And if he would stop, what are they going to do? They're going to stop. And so the Lord led them into this segmented journey until they came to camp at Rephidim. What's remarkable about this camp location? I don't mean geographically, but what's the characteristic of it that's remarkable that's mentioned here?
No water.
Now, the people had a response. What was their response to this no water in verse 2?
They're angry. They want water to drink. They need it.
They want water. And in one sense, you can understand some of their desire for the water. You go without water for a few days, you're going to be saying, "Hey, let's see if we can figure this out as well." But how did they express it?
They demanded it. They didn't ask for it. They didn't, I think.
Well, they demanded it. Look at the text a little bit. Quarreled with Moses. What's a quarrel? But they're going back and forth. They're there with Moses going, "Hey, where's the water?" And what's Moses telling them? Why are you fighting with me? And
why do you test the Lord?
Why do you test the Lord? What's the pattern been every time the people have come and said, why did you bring us out to die this way?
Testing
of the Lord. The pattern is, God's going to provide. Don't get impatient. You know, I don't want to go beyond what we really know. At the same time, it's easy to look at this from the Lord's perspective, I think, and get it right. What do the people say every time they don't have everything they think they need at that moment? Why'd you bring us to die this way? Has God led them to any death yet? How many have died of hunger? How many have died from the Egyptian army? How many have died from any of these threats? God has shown them time and time again that He is the master of their fate. I don't even know if fate's a good word. We probably ought to look that up for a definition. I don't know if I would want to use that word. But the master of the outcome of the events that are going on in their lives. God isn't losing control of one bit. And every time something happens, Moses says, why are you trying to lay this at my feet? God has led us here. God, he didn't say that in this case, but that's absolutely the truth. God led us here. Trust God. Why are you testing God? Because that's what they're doing. And they're showing the level of their faith, are they not?
Yeah.
Do they have any faith that God's going to take care of them?
No.
Should they?
Yeah.
I mean, few people in the existence of the time on this earth have had as many clear examples as they have had. But it doesn't take them years of plenty or prosperity to begin to rely on themselves and rely on Moses. It takes them a few days, and they've already forgotten what God has done. So give us water to drink. Now, in one sense, there's two ways to answer this question, and they're both got some right in it, some correctness to it. Is this a reasonable request?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's reasonable when you've gone without water for a period of time to say, I really do need something to drink here. On the other hand, is it reasonable from a perspective of who God is? It might be if you stopped and had a prayer meeting. God, we trust you. We know you're going to take care of us, and however you take care of us is fine, but we're thirsty. There's nothing wrong with that. To go to Moses and start a fight with him over the fact they don't have any water when he isn't even the one that led them to this campsite is kind of silly or incorrect, because God led them there. And it's interesting to think about their faith at this point. We've already talked about it this morning, but there's something missing here, isn't there? God did great miracles to call them out of Egypt. He did great miracles to take them to this point. And this isn't the time frame that fits what Jesus said, that in order to enter the kingdom of heaven, you need to be born again. But it's the nature of that rebirth that is lacking. They're still approaching their trek and their existence in relationship to God based on the events of life in this world and what they can see. They have not yet, and most of them will not, get beyond what they can see. They're going to spend 40 years traipsing through the desert, because when they come to the time that they could go into Canaan, they can't get beyond what they can see and really perceive the character, nature, power, and attributes of God, the one that has put all this together for them and kept his promises to Abraham. They even don't really, truly trust the promises given to Abraham, do they? Abraham would have known God was going to care for him. Look at what Abraham did out of his faith with his son Isaac. Oh, this is the child of the promise. Abraham really wanted Esau to be the child of the promise. God said, no. Not going to come through Esau. It's going to come through Isaac. Now go kill him. And Abraham couldn't calculate a specific answer for how God was going to make this happen, but Abraham trusted. These folks don't have that kind of trust, do they? There's something missing in their faith. And an interesting thing you and I can think about is it wouldn't be revealed without the hardship they're going through. Hardship reveals faith or lack of it. And so as we have lived our plush, easy lives, and I know every one of us has gone through things that we would look at and say, don't call that plush and easy. But in general, we have extremely plush and easy lives. And when those lives get disrupted, we'll find out what our faith is. So verse 3. So they're thirsty, they grumble, and to Moses, and they ask a why question. Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us here and our children and our livestock with us? And we've already talked about the fact Moses wasn't even the one to ask. In verse 4, Moses then does what the people should have done, to some extent at least. He cries out to the Lord, and his question to God, what shall I do to these people? He's in a conflict with them, and he brings a conflict in front of God. A little more and they're going to stone me. I mean, this is not a small conflict. If Moses' assessment here is correct, and I assume it is, this is coming to blows, and Moses said they're going to kill the leader, the one they perceive that has led them into this, and that's me. So the Lord gives Moses an answer and direction. He says, all right, take some of the elders with you, go before the people, we're in verse 5, and by the way, take with you your staff, the one you used at the Nile, to strike the Nile. And then go. And in verse 6 he says, look, see, observe. This is a strong statement. I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, strike the rock, and water will come out, so the people will drink. So Moses is given direction to take some elders with him, to take the staff. That's the staff that was given to Moses clear back at Mount Sinai that he again used in front of the Egyptians, the one that would turn into a snake and the one that when he struck the Nile turned it to blood. And God said, I'll be there and I will give the water to people to drink out of the rock. And so Moses did as directed, and the elders got to see the power of God exercised as Moses was obedient and struck the rock. Now in verse 7, it says, Moses named the place Massa and Meribah due to the quarrel. Well, the word Massa equals temptation, and the word Meribah equals strife or contention. So Moses saw this as a place where they were tempted, and they failed the temptation, and they quarreled. And he said, it was that he named it those because they tested the Lord. And what their question was, is the Lord among us or not? What a question with the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud right there.
As they're eating manna.
And had quail.
And drinking water.
Now, I don't know that they were eating quail at this point, but they had eaten quail. You know, God could have probably improved their belief in his presence if he'd have picked out about six of them and went, there. Now, have you figured out I'm here yet? But that isn't what God did. And I've got a question I wrote down here to ask you. Did they actually voice this question, is God here or not? Did they actually say that?
think Moses' response is an implication. So, you know, why do you question God? So they're quarreling with Moses, but Moses' response is, why are you questioning God?
Yeah, Moses is looking at their actions, and by their actions, they're acting like God is not here. And you know, one thing that's really sad, there will be some times as you look at the formation of the nation of Israel where you could find some exceptions to this. Joshua will be one at some point. But where is the two or three or ten that are going, hey, wait a minute, stop. I'm not part of you if you're going to go this way. I'm over here with Moses' team. Because look at what God's... Where is the one or two or three out of the million-plus people that we believe are likely there? That's really sad. But it also really tells a story. Apart from the work of the Spirit of God in our lives, nobody responds. Nobody responds. Questions or comments over those first seven verses?
Rick, I was just thinking about how Paul basically looks back on this situation in Romans 9 and in Romans 11 and kind of gives us a glimpse about, you're talking about stamping them out. Well, God does stamp them out in the wilderness. He makes that generation die. And so, you know, it's because of the belief of the remnant that he does that, and then the remnant ends up going into Israel and stuff too. So it's interesting to consider that, you know, God is forbearing with the sins of the people. It seems like for the purpose of establishing a generation of faith in the seed of Abraham that ends up going into the promised land.
Well, and that concept of the remnant is real and huge. And it showed up when we were going through Genesis. I don't remember the exact details of where it came up. I think it was when Joseph was responding to his brothers, but I'm not sure about that. But that remnant is very real, and you mentioned it's certainly mentioned in Romans 9, not all Israel is Israel. And that's a real good point. And I guess that's kind of a corollary way of saying what I said a minute ago. Where's the one or two or where is that remnant right now? And they're yet to come, or they're too young to be out there saying it. God hasn't led them into that yet. That's a good point. Anything
there
else?
The verse there, they say where he's supposed to take the elders with him.
Yes.
But it doesn't really expand on that as far as they go.
It doesn't. It just says he did what he was told. So how many and which ones, we don't even know the answer to that. But we know he took some of the leaders of the tribes, and maybe he took a leader from each tribe. That's fairly consistent in some situations, but we're just not given any inner information. But take some of those leaders with you. Let them get up close and personal and see this happen. And
I just kinda, I think it's interesting too that God stood on the rock. I mean, whether that's the pillar of cloud standing there, he's making it very clear this water isn't coming from Moses striking the rock, it's coming from me.
Yeah, and the thing we don't know, I mean, that said to Moses, did the people see God on the rock too, or was that just something Moses was believing in faith because God said he would be there? Was it something visible? God, it isn't revealed in what Moses wrote about what that presence looked like, if it was physically visible or not. But.
Yeah, I was thinking Horeb, while Moses is on Horeb, we're going to see what the remnant looks like.
Yeah.
Here in a chapter or two. Like,
don't worry about it.
The majority are going to be worshiping the golden calf.
Yeah. Yeah, the people are going to follow the same pattern they've been following so far, looking for a different God to follow despite what God has done. Yep. Okay, well, let's go on and let's look at verses 8 through 16. So beginning in verse 8, now Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out and fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under the sun." Moses built an altar and named it, "The Lord is my banner." And he said, "The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation." I find this passage interesting because it links back into some things we've done before, and we'll get there. So in verse 8, Amalek came and fought Israel. Now this might be a little bit vague. Maybe vague's not the right word, but tedious. Who's Amalek? Does anybody remember who Amalek is? Okay, go over to Genesis chapter 36. And we're going to read verses 4 through 12. Genesis 36, 4 through 12. Okay. Now, we're over into the world of Esau. And verse 1 starts with, I can't do this way. Hang on a second. All right. Verse 1 starts with, now these are the records of the generations of Esau, that is Edom. Skipping now down to verse 4. Ada bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basemath bore Reuel, and Oholibamah bore Jeush, and Jalem, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Then Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all his household and his livestock and his cattle and all his goods which he had acquired in the land of Canaan. And he went to another land away from his brother Jacob, for their property had become too great for them to live together. And the land where they sojourned could not sustain them because of their livestock. So Esau lived in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. These are the records of the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in the hill country of Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Esau's wife Ada; Reuel, the son of Esau's wife Basemath. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, and Gatam, and Kenaz. Timnah was a concubine of Esau's son Eliphaz, and she bore him Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Esau's wife Ada. So we just saw who Abimelech is. If we go back through the generations, you could start with Abraham. He was the father of Esau and Isaac.
Ishmael.
Sorry. I don't mean to say, Ishmael. Oh yeah, I got to go a few more generations. Ishmael and Isaac, thank you. And then Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Thank you. And then Esau was the father of Eliphaz, who was the father of Amalek. So this would be Jacob's brother's grandson, okay, Amalek. And there's a few generations there between Abraham and Amalek. And it also said where he was. Do you remember where he was?
Well,
yeah, the hill country of Seir. It's going to be south of the Canaan area at this time. South in this map we had here, this is the Dead Sea. It's going to be south of there, and they're down in the hill country. And he went away from Jacob because between Jacob and Esau they had been so blessed that there just wasn't enough room for everybody. So he had gone down in there, into the area of, it was going to become Edom, and Esau would be the father of the Edomites. So that's who he was, and that's basically where they are. So Amalek is one of the grandchildren of Esau, who saw himself as a rival, in some respects at least, early on, he had a strong death wish for Jacob when the blessings were given, because Jacob got the blessing that Esau believed should have been his, even though he had traded it off. Nonetheless, they became friendly when Jacob came back, or at least weren't fighting enemies when Jacob came back with his family and resettled in the Canaanite area. And so, but here's a grandson, and he's looking out here at, these are relatives. This isn't some Canaanite group, which would still be relatives, but it would be back, not, it would be back through Noah, not through Abraham. But here's relatives through the Abrahamic line, and they come down to fight against Israel. And we are not given their specific stated motives here, but I think it's fairly obvious that they know the promises, and they are really not real thrilled with the idea of these Israelites finding their way up and taking the land of Canaan. They very likely have heard about the miracles and the destruction of the Egyptian army that could hardly be kept quiet for a long time. And so they're down here to do battle with their distant, somewhat distant kinsmen. And so in verse 9, Moses says to Joshua, pick some men and go fight Amalek. What else does Moses tell Joshua is going to be occurring during this fight?
He's going to be on top of the hill.
I'm going to go up on the hill, and I will have the staff of God in my hand. We're not given any information about God telling Moses how to handle this and how to and what the miracle is going to be, but clearly Moses is anticipating something. He's got this staff that's the sign that God gave him. It will be with him. And so in verse 10, we see that Joshua obeyed. He goes out with his army to fight Amalek. And with Moses, we see two people go, Aaron and Hur, and they go out to the top of the hill. Now, I could take you on a little bit of a roundabout tour, but I'm going to jump right to the punchline for this. Look at 1 Corinthians 2, 18 and 19. 1 Corinthians 2, 18 and 19. Whoops, that's not right. Turn the page. Turn the page. That's going to be hard to do, isn't it? Wonder what I did wrong. What's that? I don't know. I know where I can go back and find it real quick, though. Hang on. I said I could. We are in verse 9. Well, I read it. So, where were you telling me it might be?
That was right. That was when he talked about the rock.
So, here it is. 1 Corinthians 2. Is that what I told you?
No.
And this says 19 and 20. And that's not any better. But I look. Oh! Let's change that. Let's try 1 Chronicles. 2:19 and 20. I think that's going to work a lot better. First Chronicles 2:19-20. See if I can get over there. 2:19-20. Abbreviations can get you. And that one got me. Okay. 2:19-20. When Azubah died, Caleb married Ephrath, who bore him Hur. Hur became the father of Uri, and Uri became the father of Bezalel. So, who was Hur? Is the question. And he was the son of Caleb. So Joshua and Caleb in the conquest of the Canaanite land are going to play a huge role. And when Moses goes out to be on the hill with his staff, he takes the son of Caleb with him. And I just found that very interesting. And so they get out there in verse 11, and we see the pattern develop that when Moses is his hands up, that Israel's winning, but when his hands are down, Israel is losing. Well, what's the problem with that?
Can't hold his hands up forever.
If you've never done this, just try it. See how long you can hold your hands up. Because they get heavier and heavier and heavier. So what's the solution? No, close.
Sets him down on a stone.
They set him on a stone. That gets him down where, because if they didn't set him down, imagine somebody standing holding their arms up. Now you want to help them hold their arms up. What do you have to do?
Same thing.
Why don't you sit down, Moses? This will be a lot easier. And so they set him down, and then Aaron and Hur hold up his hands. Now, they went out there in the morning. That's when Moses told Joshua to go start the battle, right? How long are they out there in this battle?
Down until sunset.
Until sunset. So if you want to think about it, you and I would probably have trouble with 15 or 20 minutes trying to hold our arms up. And they're out there all day long. But what's the end result? Joshua overwhelms Amalek and his people. You know, we could reword that and still be just as correct, couldn't we? God, through the use of Joshua, overwhelmed Amalek and his people. And we know that God takes an affront at Amalek's actions. Why do we see that? In verse 14, the Lord said to Moses, "Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua." Joshua, following Moses, is going to become the leader of the Israelite people. It's through the conquest of Canaan, and God wants to make sure it gets passed down, and then Joshua knows, and subsequent people will know, that there is something written down in a book at the direction of God. And that is this, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. How would you like to have that for a family heritage? God's going to take Amalek out of existence. So that's his intention. And why do you suppose that God would do that?
They were coming against the nation of Israel instead of joining them. So.
Yeah. You tried to wipe out Israel, and so now I'm going to, God says, wipe out you. Now, who is going to do the wiping out? Well, okay, we just said God said he's going to do it. But in the life of the Old Testament, where does this occur? Well, we're going to get there. Let's start here. 1 Samuel 15:1-9. 1 Samuel 15:1-9. I didn't misunderstand my definition, my abbreviation for Samuel, I'm sure. 1 Samuel 15, 1 through 9. Okay. You remember who King Saul was, first king over Israel. Then Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up out of Egypt." Oh, that's a pretty direct connection, isn't it? "Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has. Do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." Pretty extreme, but that's God's declaration. "Then Saul summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. Saul came to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the valley. Saul said to the Kenites, 'Go, depart. Go down from among the Amalekites so that I do not destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt.'" Saul got it. These people were kind. Get out of the way. "So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed." So how did Saul do here?
Not good.
Yeah. And in this era, when you don't do good as a king, what happens? Who's there? Samuel. Oh, okay. So Samuel calls out Saul in the subsequent verses. And Saul's got the excuse he's going to sacrifice these wonderful things. Do you think for a second Saul had any intention of sacrificing all these wonderful things?
No.
But anyway, he's supposed to. And here's the end of the rebuke, down in verses 18 and 19. Well, we'll start with 17. Samuel said, "Is it not true, though you were little in your own eyes, you were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel? And the Lord sent you on a mission. And he said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they're exterminated. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord?'" And of course, that's when Saul starts doing his defensive dance. And one of the things that comes out of this is Agag is still alive, the king. And this is what happens to Agag down in verses 32 and 33. "Samuel said, 'Bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites.' And Agag came to him cheerfully. And Agag said, 'Surely the bitterness of death is past.' But Samuel said, 'As your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women.' And Samuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal." And there's lots of sermons made up out of hacking Agag to pieces as an illustration of being obedient to what God tells people to do. But we're not done yet. And we had a lot of fun with this. Oh, not this one yet. Got one more first. Go over to 1 Samuel 30. 1 Samuel 30. And we're going to look at verses 1 through 6. Because the Amalekites are not done being exterminated. And they're not done fighting back. And in verses 1 through 6, we see this in chapter 30 of 1 Samuel. "Then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites," they're still around, "had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went on their way. When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. Now David's two wives had been taken captive, Ahinoam and the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. So we've got this calamity that's occurred where the Amalekites have come and caused more problems. In verse 8, David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them?" And he, God said, "Pursue him, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all." And so that's what he's doing, beginning in verse 11. Now they found an Egyptian in the field. They're down there, headed down to pick him up, pick up this band that they're tracing, and gave him bread, and he ate, and he provided him water to drink. Then they gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins, and he ate. Then his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. David said to him, "To whom do you belong, and where are you from?" And he said, "I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. We made a raid on the Negev in the Cherethites, and on that which belongs to Judah, and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." Then David said to him, "Will you bring me down to this band?" And he said, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hand of my master, and I will bring you down to this band." When he had brought him down, behold, there they were spread over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. David slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. But nothing of theirs was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that they had taken for themselves. David brought it all back. So David had captured all the sheep and the cattle which the people drove ahead of the other livestock. And they said, "This is David's spoil." And they're going to go on and talk about dividing the spoil. But so David gets involved. He's both attacked by the Amalekites, and as far as this army's concerned, he killed all but 400. Now go over to Esther 3:1. Many years have gone by the time we get to Esther, and I'm going to, and so here we are, and my brain just stopped. And so here we are, and we see Haman introduced there in chapter 3, verse 1. And how is he described? I'll just let you tell me.
Agagite.
Haman the Agagite. He is a descendant of Agag. And he still remembers, because he's called the Agagite. And so the book of Esther is also about God's plan for destruction and wiping the Amalekites off the map of history going forward. And I think that to me, that's just fascinating, that when God said he was going to do this, he had the patience and the tenacity to stay right with it and keep it going. And by the way, one of the things we didn't read, God told Saul, "Don't spare one." And every time that God told them to not spare anybody, and yet they spared somebody, it caused problems for the Israelites. And it also caused problems for Saul, because that's when God said, "You've lost the mantle of kingship." And God made it clear that his time as a king was going to come to an end. So let's go back to Exodus chapter 17. Any comments about that? Amalekite peace so far? Got a little more we're going to do. Okay. Well, if we continue with Exodus 17 in verse 14, he told Moses to write it down in a book. When you go look at the translation for that from Hebrew, it could also be called a missive or a book. It's a writing, a letter, a legal document, all of those things. This word might be used to say that. And he tells Moses to write it down. Why is Moses equipped, probably, to do this? How was Moses educated? He was educated by the Egyptians and in multiple languages. And so speaking, he would have had multiple languages. When you look at the historical development of things, now it all depends upon some things like we saw David Roll and his discussion of matching the timelines of history with the timelines of Egypt and so on and so on. But David Roll worked hard to make a case that at the time of Joseph, when Joseph would have been taken captive, the Egyptians were working with hieroglyphics. I can't talk. What's that?
Hieroglyphics.
Hieroglyphics. And so it's all pictures. And at the time about of Joseph is the time when the alphabet began to be developed. And David Roll even believes that Joseph was likely a part of that because of its relationship to the Egyptian symbols. Nonetheless, here is Moses being asked to write a book. And so Moses is told to put this down, and Moses would be one that would be more likely to have the education to write this down and to record it and keep it. And then in verse 15, we see that Moses builds an altar. And in this altar, he said, "The Lord is my banner and over his people." And I want to read that. Just go back to the verse for a moment and read it there, get it right. Moses built an altar and named it, "The Lord is my banner." And when we see that, it means that he made the Lord himself to be the standard of the people. That word banner there is Jehovah Nissi. And that is that suffix Nissi on there means it's personal, that it's a rallying point, that it's a central part of the characteristic of it. And in Hebrew, it really says the Lord, really it says Jehovah Nissi is Jehovah Nissi, meaning the Lord is, this is the Lord, and it's personal, and he is the personal standard now and is really the measuring stick of the people and their goals, their very existence as a group. And so he is saying we're essentially people of God and measured by who God is. And we ourselves are measured by who God is. And then in verse 16, he says, "The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have a war against Amalek from generation to generation." And so that's where we get this declaration that God has declared war on Amalek. Says it again in addition to what he asked to be written down to be given to Joshua. And so this war is going to continue. What consequences would you say came out of the continued Amalekite attack through the generations, maybe even up into today? Can you see similarities in what's going on today? What would you say?
Nothing's changed. The Persians want to kill the Jews. Hamas wants to kill the Jews. Everybody there wants to kill the Jews. Now, believe it or not, American whites want to go from river to the sea to
annihilate the Jews. What's changed?
Yeah, well, some do. We won't paint that brush completely with everybody.
No,
but
I just said some.
Some, but certainly, there this war, this attitude continues on, and it's very much out of the spirit, at least, of what you see between the Amalekites and the Jewish nation today. Go over to Psalm 83. Just about out of time here. We're going to look at verses 2 through 4. Psalm 83. And I guess I'll start with verse 1. This is a cry of the psalmist. And this is what he says. Oh God, do not remain quiet. Do not be silent. And oh God, do not be still. For behold, your enemies make an uproar, and those who hate you have exalted themselves. They make shrewd plans against your people and conspire together against your treasured ones. They have said, come, let us wipe them out as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. I'm going to keep reading. That for they have conspired together with one mind against you. They make a covenant, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre, Assyria, who has joined with them. They have become a help to the children of Lot. Goes clear back to the division between Lot and then Abram as they divided their way between them. And so this is what the Israelites felt, what they sensed was going on in their various troubles, and the psalmist here is crying out to God, they're all against us. Today you could write that same psalm, couldn't you? Very easily. You might change some of the names. You might not recognize it goes back to the Amalekites, or it goes back to Lot, or it goes back to maybe the rivalry between Esau and Jacob, or Ishmael and Isaac. But that strife exists yet to this day. And the Amalekites are included in that list. And who is the one fighting against the Amalekites in our lesson today? God himself. And you can bet that the promises made to Abraham will be fulfilled. Does that mean the Israel we see today is the Israel of end times? I think so, but even if that Israel takes a hit, even if that Israel is harmed greatly and looks like it's on its way out, you can trust that ultimately the promises to Abraham will be fulfilled. Questions, comments? Okay, well, we'll pick it up with chapter 18 next time.